On the 16th of October this year, 105 of the nations who are represented in the General Assembly of the United Nations voted to invite the Palestine Liberation Organization to participate in the scheduled debate on what is called the, quote, Palestine question. This vote, there were only four nays, went a long way towards convincing the Arab chiefs of state who were about to assemble in Rabat for a summit conference that they could take the necessary actions to declare the Palestine Liberation Organization a government in exile, a decision which in fact aborted Secretary Kissinger's assiduously undertaken set of negotiations, step-by-step negotiations, for it said in effect that the Arab world will not enter into political arrangements with Israel. How can Israel deal with a quasi-governmental body whose stated purpose is to eliminate its existence? The world body, the United Nations, born out of the hope that men would somehow find an avenue towards peace after all these centuries of recurring wars, unfortunately often contributes by its actions to tension and injustice and war itself. This present decision to legitimatize the Palestinian terrorists is not only wrong on the face of it. These men have the blood of innocent people on their hands. It's not only wrong in being a hapless undertaking. How can you ask a nation to negotiate with those who are determined to destroy it? But it is wrong even within the narrow frame of reference which has been suggested by the Senator Fulbright's in the United States and by the French Ministry of State, Mr. Sauvignage, who argue that once you give respectability to Yasser Arafat, he will become a responsible world statesman and that he will lead his organization into responsibility. Unfortunately, even if this magical psychological transformation were to take place, Mr. Arafat, as a responsible statesman in the world of competitive nationalisms, which is our world, must inevitably become an expansionist. For the Palestine state, which is now proposed, consisting of the West Bank and of Gaza, is not a viable entity. It cannot now provide jobs, food sufficient for those who live there. One in every four jobs which brings in wages and food and housing monies to the Arabs of the West Bank and Gaza is an Israeli job. The country is already overcrowded. How can it absorb 250,000 Palestine refugees from the camps of Lebanon, 150,000 Palestine refugees from the camps in Syria, the perhaps 300,000 Palestinians who have been kept in camps in the Jordan? Inevitably, Mr. Arafat, whoever is head of such a state, must become an expansionist leader, look for new territories, new cities, new ports, new markets, new industry. And given the jingoism, given the ideology, given the hates of that part of the world, he cannot ever really lead a country into some kind of peaceful coexistence with Israel. The United Nations, in legitimatizing this particular philosophy, these particular men, has not made a contribution towards world's peace. Indeed, increasingly, when it deals with the Middle East, the United Nations is only complicating the issue and making it more difficult for peace to be achieved. I understand that there's a saying among the correspondents who routinely report doings at the United Nations that if the Arab states were to propose a motion censuring Israel because its scientists declared that the world is round, that motion would overwhelmingly pass. For given oil, given the petrodollars, given the eagerness of Russia for Persian Gulf ports and for influence in the Arab world, given the third world's hatred of the white world, given the Arab bloc and the third world bloc and the Chinese bloc and the Russian satellite bloc, anything that the Arab world wishes to propose will be disposed of in a way inimical to the interests of Israel, inimical to simple justice. And the West, where one might expect to find a more balanced judgment on activities in the Middle East, the West will usually content itself by abstaining from these votes because they don't want to offend those who own the petrodollars and those who have the markets. And they tell the Israelis again and again, you know, the old child's proverb, sticks and stones may hurt my bones, but names will never hurt me. What are they doing but passing paper resolutions? Unfortunately, the record written by these resolutions is often cited by Arab propagandists when they appear before councils of world affairs and church groups in the world. And when they can say what is in fact a fact, that the General Assembly and the Security Council of the United Nations have often and again censured Israel for acts of retaliation, for acts of violence, and have never once censured an Arab country or censored Arab terrorism, it becomes a compelling argument, particularly among people who are relatively innocent and romantic, who assume that a decision of the world body is a judgment of justice, of equity, by the countries of the world, when it is nothing more than hatred and bitterness and prudence, all bundled up in a particular vote. Several months ago, a man who has for years covered the United Nations for the New York Times, Robert Alden, commented on the feeling of what he calls the seething hostility towards Israel, which exists in the UN body. Just after the October war of a year ago, he wrote, many of the countries involved enjoy normal relations with Israel, but when it comes to the United Nations, the realities of bloc politics prevail. The matter of anti-Jewishness, it cannot be called anti-Semitism in the United Nations because the Arabs are Semites, is more elusive. In the past, Mr. Malik, Russia, has sarcastically referred to the Jews as, in Malik's words, the chosen people, and he's referred to the size of Jewish noses. On social occasions, here also diplomats make reference to Jews as shrewd traders willing to take unfair advantage. To this can now be added Mr. Malik's own words during the October debate, quote, like savage barbaric tribes in their mad destruction, they have annihilated, destroyed, and tried to remove from the surface of the earth cities, villages, the cultural heritage of mankind. They, the Jews, have ravaged entire civilizations. And those delegates coming from countries which have no past association with and little knowledge of Jewish history, the cumulative effect of endless repetition of such speeches and attitudes has produced the desired results. Now, this coming week, we're going to see another of these moments, these very ugly moments in the life of the United Nations. The debate on the Palestine question is to take place, and Mr. Arafat or one of his delegates will be in place. And he'd be welcomed enthusiastically by most of the delegations of the United Nations. As they drive into their deliberations, they will pass through a demonstration in New York. And most of them will look down their noses and comment wryly that it's really too bad that the United Nations is located in this Jew city. They don't represent the United States and they don't represent the world, those howling people out there. And when they get into the United Nations, the French delegation, the delegation of a country whose ambassador in Belgium was held prisoner by representatives of this Palestine Liberation Organization just 3 weeks ago, will applaud. The French are realists, and just a week after that particular episode, the French foreign minister visited happily with Yasser Arafat in Beirut. The United States will not applaud. The United States was one of the four countries that voted against inviting Mr. Arafat. It was Mr. Arafat who 2 years ago gave over the airways the order to kill the American ambassador to the Sudan in Khartoum, who was being held captive by Arab terrorists. They recognize that the legitimization of Arafat is a blow to Mr. Kissinger and to American policy, a deliberate blow. But there are already indications that American diplomats have informally met with the Palestine Liberation Organization. And that consummate realist that he prides himself on being, Mr. Kissinger, will certainly find reasons to explain in short time to Israel why the United States believes that Israel ought to be meeting and negotiating with these people. I'd like simply to give you some feeling of the mood of these debates. The United Nations is little reported, and what little is said is badly reported. And occasionally, when one of the educational channels displays or televises the debates, most of us are shocked at the total lack of respect for truth and for a simple fact which exists there. And it's well to remember that this is the ordinary course of business. And I think it's important for Jews particularly to recognize the special role which Jews, Israel in this case, is again forced to play. Often the lone voice crying in the wilderness that there is a truth and not simply the weight of power. You recall in April of this year, three Arab terrorists came over to Israel from Lebanon, from Fatah land, and they went into a little Israeli village called Kiryat Shemona. They went to the school hoping to find children in the school, as they were to be found later in Maalot, but the school was empty. And so they burst into an apartment building, and they kicked in door after door and machine gunned whoever was in the rooms. They killed 18. They threw the children off the parapet of the roof. They wounded some 15 others as they tried to escape. And then they were ultimately destroyed in a shootout with the Israel Defense Force. The next night, the Israelis crossed over into Fatah land, and they destroyed some 22 houses of known terrorists, and they captured 10 terrorists and brought them back with them to Israel. Both Lebanon and Israel wrote letters explaining the issue to the United Nations. And on the 14th of April, in the Security Council, the debate began. Now, chairing the Security Council for this debate was Iraq. Iraq is not only an Arab state, but it's a state which has refused to acknowledge the ceasefire of 1973. Two of the five permanent members of the Security Council have no diplomatic relations with Israel, the Soviet Union, and China. And five of the 10 elected members of the Security Council have no relationships with Israel or have broken relationships with Israel. The debate began with a man by the name of Kalani, representing Syria, saying, among other things, "The Israeli representative has described Palestinians in terms more worthy of him, as assassins, murderers, and barbarians. His purpose was to make the Arab world forget that the Palestinian Arabs were a people with their own identity and inalienable rights, driven from their country by a foreign, racist, and colonialist conquest. The true question before the council was the state terrorism practiced by Israel as a doctrine, faith, and religious profession. State terrorism was fundamentally distinct from acts of individual violence, which were the expressions of despair." This gentleman was followed by Ismail Fahmy, the foreign minister of Egypt, who often embraces Mr. Kissinger, who said in part, "The representative of Israel had the audacity to speak about what he called Arab terrorists. The Council may recall that the memory of the Palestinian nation was still haunted by horrendous atrocities to which they and their homeland had been so systematically subjected since 1948. Was it not upon the debris of their homes, upon the maimed and mutilated bodies of their men, women, and children, that Israel was erected? He was followed by the Minister of Kuwait, Mr. Al-Sabah, who said, among other things, Lebanon was not obliged to prevent the occurrence of disorders or disturbances in territories occupied by Israel or under its control. Lebanon was not obliged to protect Israel from the inevitable consequences resulted from its policy and conduct towards the Palestinian people and rendering them homeless and denying their right to self-determination, occupying their lands, usurping their wealth, and committing heinous crimes against their sons and treating them as if they were a subhuman race devoid of national and human rights, recognized by all nations without exception. The debate that went on that day with the Arab states speaking in this vein, Mr. Tekoa, representing Israel, set the record straight. But not another voice was raised. Not a single voice was raised in the United Nations saying, this isn't true, except the voice of Israel. The following day, on the 16th of April, Mr. Malik, representing the Soviet Union, began. He said that the latest criminal act of the Israeli aggressors was one new link in the chain of crimes they had committed. The Israeli extremists were trying, by means of terror elevated to the status of state policy, by intimidation and aggression, to achieve the fulfillment of their plans for annexation and appropriation of the lands of others, and the Israelization of the Arab territories which they had seized. All that was a flagrant violation of the principle acknowledged and confirmed by the United Nations of the inadmissibility of acquisition of territory by means of war or the use of force. Such armed raids by the Israeli military circles were reminiscent of the worst times of the domination of the Hitlerites in territories they had temporarily occupied during the Second World War. They pursued a policy of scorched earth and the total annihilation of a peaceful population on the pretext of retaliatory measures against the acts of patriots. He was followed by the representative of Mauritania, Mr. El Hassan. The issue involved was a very grave injustice incarnate in Israel, the creation of which was and remained a permanent source of conflict, which had developed and grown until it acquired the scope and size that it possessed. 26 years ago, the people of Palestine had lived in peace. They lived in comfort in their own land and in their own homes. There was a feeling of tolerance, community, and fraternity. These people, whose lives and existence were won over the centuries with the geography and earth of Palestine itself, were evicted from their homes. Their aspirations were stifled, as was their eagerness for justice and human dignity. The people were uprooted and condemned to wander, condemned perhaps to extinction by Israel, whose fate had been had to be created on the ideology of Zionism. And then Mr. Chuang Yen spoke for China. China, he said, sternly condemned the Israeli Zionists for their fresh crime of aggression and firmly supported the just stand of the Lebanese government and the people in opposing aggression and in safeguarding national independence, sovereignty, and territorial inviolability. The Arab and the Palestinian peoples would certainly foil all the superpower schemes for manipulating the Middle East situation, defeat the Israeli aggressors, recover their occupied territories, and regain their national rights. The Indonesian delegate, Mr. Anwar Sani, said the latest raids and destruction perpetrated by Israeli forces in Lebanese villages could hardly pave the way for a new era of peaceful negotiations. Until the Palestinian refugees were allowed to enjoy their inalienable rights and return home, it would be illusory to hope that acts of violence born out of political despair and frustration would cease. Nor could there be any realistic prospect of lasting peace in the area. Indonesia did not condone violence. However, it did not view acts of violence by desperate and frustrated people deprived of their rights and chased away by violence from their homeland in the same light as acts of violence by a government as its official policy. State terrorism by Israel could not be tolerated, as it was a grave violation of the Charter of the United Nations. That's the second level of states. They question Israel's right to exist. They see only the want, the hurt, the rights of others. Finally, Europe began to be heard from. First England, then France. You might expect some balance in these statements, instead of which we find in the case of Mr. Ivor Richards, speaking on behalf of the United Kingdom, is a very narrow delineation of the problem and a tut-tutting about terrorism in general. Mr. Richards said the United Kingdom deplored all acts of violence and terrorism in the Middle East, wherever and by whomsoever they were committed. The United Nations could understand, sympathize with, and indeed to an extent associate itself with the strong indignation that the tragic incident aroused in Israel. If it were established that the three terrorists entered Israel from Lebanon, it would be right to remind the Lebanese government of their duty under international law to take reasonable steps to prevent organization on its territories of irregular forces. Violence could not justify more violence. A government-organized operation in the territory of another sovereign state could not be justified under the Charter. As if there wasn't 25 years of evidence that the camps were being organized by and run by the terrorists and that they were used them as bases for their operations. And finally, Mr. Louis de Gringal, speaking on behalf of France, said, "Nothing could establish with any degree of certainty that the operation carried out by a Palestinian commando or group originated in or received support upon Lebanese soil. France condemns violence." That's it. The United States said not a word. So finally, on the third day of the debate, the United States delegate moved an amendment to the resolution before the body that would have specifically included reference to Kiryat Shmona among the acts of violence which take place in the Middle East. That resolution, which was defeated 6-7 with 2 abstentions, and the final unanimous vote of censure against Israel for the act against Kiryat Shmona passed the United Nations Security Council unanimously. This is the entire record. You would not have believed that anyone knew about Fatahland, anyone knew about El Fatah, anyone had any concern about terrorism as such. The record is one in which Israel is censured for protecting its citizens, and all violence any place in the world by anyone is very broadly condemned, but without any specific reference to the Arabs, the Palestine Liberation Organization, to El Fatah, to the host countries, Lebanon, Syria, where these groups have massed and from which they've attacked. Now that's the record that's being written at the United Nations. And when we look at the United Nations as an institution, we must not only be chagrined by the failure of its peacekeeping mission. It was prevented, as you remember, by the veto of the Soviet Union from taking any action when the Soviet Union invaded Hungary, and again when it invaded Czechoslovakia. It was prevented by the veto of the United States from taking any effective action when the United States escalated the war in Southeast Asia. But more than the failure of these peacekeeping activities when they run counter to the interests of the major powers, is the failure of the United Nations even to become what it can be in the limited terms of reference suggested by its apologies, that it is an effective and useful town meeting of the world, a place where issues are aired, where new facts are raised, where the world gains new insight into the problems which confront it. In point of fact, the United Nations is not such a town meeting. It's a place where hatred is given free voice and where those who know better are moved by prudence not to raise their voices. If an archaeologist 2,000 years from now were to recover of our world only the record of the United Nations, you would be amazed at the gargantuan and grotesque history which he would reconstruct out of that record. Israel would be a vast superpower whose expansionist, militarist government threatens the safety and security of all nations. And the Arabs are saints who renounce violence and force, and we go on and on from there. Now, I'm sure many of you remember, as I do, watching on a June day in 1945, when 50 of the countries of the world put their signature to the Charter of the United Nations, which had been worked out in San Francisco. And most of us were concerned that summer that the United States would not repeat its tragic relationship with the League of Nations, would not retreat from war into isolationism. And we were very proud when a month later, in a very brief time, The Senate of the United States ratified the United Nations Treaty, and we have been, as a country, the major financial support of all of its activities. To read the Charter of the United Nations in light of what has happened is to suggest the measure of the fall from grace. The words are simple. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life and larger freedom. For these ends, to practice tolerance and to live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, and to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security, and to ensure by the acceptance of principles and the institution of methods that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest, and to employ international machinery for the promotion of economic and social advancement of all peoples, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims, and then follows the actual terms of the Charter. From the very beginning, the United Nations lacked a power, an authority, moral and political, which was larger than that of the authority of the individual member states. You recall that when Great Britain returned to the United Nations the trusteeship mandate over Palestine, which had been granted to it by the League of Nations, the United Nations, after great debate, voted to partition Palestine into a Jewish state and a Palestinian state, and Jerusalem was to be a United Nations enclave, a corpus separatum. Members of the United Nations, Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, immediately announced that they would not accept this decision, though it was the will of the world, and they launched the war of 1947 against the issue. In response to this direct challenge to their authority, the United Nations sent not a single soldier to the Middle East and was not able to take a single effective act of power in order to defend its decisions. In point of fact, the only act of which it was capable was to work out arrangements for a ceasefire in place when it became clear to the leaders of the Arab world that they would not be able to drive the issue into the sea. And after this ceasefire had been brought into being, the United Nations took over responsibility for the so-called Palestinian refugees, UNRWA was created, and it chose to not to look at the political consequences of these refugee camps, how the refusal of the Arab world, manpower poor, to integrate these people into their own economy was not only a burden on the finance of the world, but was equally a determined political effort to maintain the misery of these people as a political ploy. They continued without comment to support this political undertaking. They made no protest when it became clear that the more militant groups were using the camps as recruiting grounds. When the schools, the camps were given over to the militants, to those who preached and taught hate. Though it was pointed out to them again and again that the numbers of people who were receiving the UNRWA card was twice and sometimes three times the number of actual refugees, no undertaking was made to revise the list. The world, that is the powerful in the world, didn't want it. And neither the Secretariat in the United Nations, which has been remarkable only for its timidity, nor the major powers of the world, which were eager for markets and oil, no one moved the United Nations towards either being able to establish through force its mandate or to expel from its body those who flaunted with force its decisions, or to see to it that its humane acts were in fact humane,
and not simply narrow political judgment. The United Nations has been able to operate as a peacekeeping force, and I use the term in quotations, only when the great powers of the world found themselves in one of those strange but inevitable moments where their interests for a UN force for peace coincided. Remember how after independence the Congo fell into chaos. There was danger of tribal war. But it was not the danger of bloodshed which moved the United Nations to send a peacekeeping force, but the fact that the Soviet Union feared that the United States, through the CIA, would impose a neo-colonial rule in the Congo, and the fact that the United States feared that the Soviet Union would send technicians and advisors. And so Dag Hammarskjöld was able to send a UN force into the Congo. But as soon as the Soviet Union became convinced the United States was not about to move, they withdrew their support from that undertaking, and it was quickly put to bed. In 1956, when England and France joined belatedly Israel in the defense of the Sinai and in its attack on the Sinai, after the Egyptian takeover of the Suez and the threat of an immediate attack on Israel, when the Soviet Union wanted to make sure that the Suez Canal remained open for its purposes, the United States wanted to make sure that France and England were not allowed to regain their foothold in the Middle East, a peacekeeping force was sent. But in 1967, when the Soviet Union was eager to unleash the United Arab Republic for its own purposes, and General Nasser ordered the UN force out of the Sinai, they were allowed to go. The war was imminent without a whimper. The record is a sad one. I suspect that Alexander Solzhenitsyn said it for all of us when he received his Nobel Peace Prize and he commented upon the United Nations, upon the tragedy that the United Nations grew up immoral in an immoral world. Unfortunately, too many people of good intentions, still look upon the United Nations as a kind of final arbiter of the needs of mankind. It's the most talked about, the most romanticized, and the least understood institution which exists in our world. I've talked to innumerable candidates for public office in Ohio and elsewhere about Israel. And I find that the less they know about Israel, the more they're liable to say to me, well, let's send it to the United Nations. They'll solve the problem. And whenever I hear that refrain, I know that I'm dealing with something very basic in the American psyche, optimism and romanticism. We need a United Nations. We need desperately some world body which will have an authority larger than that of the individual states. Because if history has any meaning, it is that as states compete for the markets of the world for advantage, they must ultimately enter into armament races, and armament races always lead to war. We need a United Nations, and Americans have responded to that truth. But we don't need this United Nations. This United Nations is a travesty, a nightmare reflection of the hope which the world, or at least we in the United States, expressed in San Francisco some 28 years ago now. What's for it, then? Some have said the United Nations can be reformed from within. Perhaps there are diplomats in its corridors who are heartsick at what they see and who suffer sleepless nights because of the words they must speak. But interestingly, the countries of the world have generally sent their most ineffective and inconsequential diplomats to the United Nations. The permanent representatives to the United Nations and the various major countries represent party loyalists who've been passed over for other office. Yes, there are times when the leaders of the world come to the United Nations to make their own pronouncements to that body. They want the forum, the public relations involved. But it seems unlikely that the nations themselves will reform it from within. And it seems more than unlikely that the Secretariat will be able to accomplish that purpose. We've had one good, noble General Secretary of the United Nations, Mr. Doug Hammarskjöld. Mr. Hammarskjöld was allowed to die in the Congo when the great powers pulled the rug under his peacekeeping hope. The other members of the Secretariat, though they are pledged to be above and beyond the pressures even of their own home country, are ultimately responsible to a body of individual states, and they know it. They've been timid men, chosen in part for their timidity, limited men, chosen in part because they are limited. And unfortunately, what you have in the United States is not a representation of the peoples of the world, but of the nations of the world. The peoples may want certain changes, but the special interests of the diplomats are not about to allow it. Who was it? Oliver Cromwell, I believe, who, facing a long do-nothing parliament, had said, "Gentlemen, you've sat here long, and you've accomplished so very little. By God, go home." And I'm often tempted to feel that about this United Nations. Go home. Return to the anonymity your activities so richly deserve. But even as I say that, I recognize that if this United Nations has outlived its miserable usefulness, we need it, a United Nations. Or rather, we need a body which will represent the will of the peoples of the world for peace, for coexistence, for human rights, for justice. The United States, the United Nations, instead of growing from strength to strength, has fallen from mediocrity to weakness. 3 years ago, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Kurt Waldheim, had the temerity to suggest to the United Nations that they should occupy themselves with the issue of terrorism. Airplanes were being hijacked and destroyed. There was Munich. Air piracy, urban violence were growing throughout the world, and Mr. Waldheim, speaking as a world citizen, said that it would be a travesty of the holy purposes invested in the United Nations if the General Assembly did not make the issue of terrorism a major item on their agenda. The sum result of his suggestion was that he was roundly censured by the General Assembly. No such debate ever took place. The issue was removed to one of the very minor subcommittees of one of the minor commissions of the United Nations. And the issue of terrorism somehow became the issue of the causes of terrorism, which became an opportunity for the third world to vent its spleen against the wealthier world. There's been no decision. There's been no effective machineries established. Nothing resulted from this whole episode except that Mr. Waldheim was taught just who he was. Servant power. To the power. What hope can I leave you with? Practically very little. But I do know that all around our world there's a growing restlessness with the old ways of doing things. There's a growing sense of urgency for cooperation, understanding. And I have a feeling deep within my soul that sometimes when the midnight is the darkest, because the dawn is just about begin to appear on the horizon. I hope, against hope, that mankind will discover ways to create a world body which will have powers and a moral authority this body utterly lacks. Not a perfect body, there's no perfection in life, but a body which will prevent ugliness and injustice of the world from being the standard of its operation. But truly the peoples of the world will be able to work to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, to reaffirm their faith in fundamental human rights, to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligation arising from treaties can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. Don't be ashamed of Israel this week. On the television, I would have said the headlines, but we may not have papers. But the television will be filled with the venom of the Palestinians and of others. But don't defend the United Nations this week. The United Nations brought this ugliness on itself. We must this week find ways to make this very clear to those among whom we live and work. The United Nations does not represent the judgment of the world on Israel. It represents a forum in which oil, gold, markets, power are brokered. And it is oil and gold and markets and power and hate which will be spoken this week, not judgment. These are not judicious men seeking a judicious decision. These are the hired mouths of the countries of the world speaking